Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I am your host, Mark Snyder, and we are back in the Billy Meier case this evening. Last night, we talked a little bit about the connection that the Plaiaren have with a race of titans. I call them a race of titans. I don't know if that's really completely accurate, but the Lyrians, who really the Lyrians, who are the forefathers of the Earth peoples and the forefathers of the Plaiaren, are from the constellation of Lyra, but in a different dimension than ours. Remember, there are seven dimensions in the material aspect of creation. Creation has seven different regions, seven different belts that counter-rotate against one another. In the fourth belt are all the material, the stars, the galaxies, the planets, everything that we see. The Ring Nebula is a part of the constellation of Lyra. The Ring Nebula is the ionizing gas of a dying star. And in Contact 238, it talks about how the Ring Nebula was created by a king of wisdom. During Billy's trip in the mothership, he described it as a gigantic eye staring at him in space. But Ptah referred to it in a little more negative way. He said in Contact Report 31, line 156, he said, "It is for us a symbol of evil lust, for power and domination, a symbol of hate, destruction, and human madness." That, in contrast to other similar natural formations, is the work of man. So this Ring Nebula was created by what they call a king of wisdom in Ishwish, who had lost himself to megalomania. And it was created, I guess, through some kind of bomb or some weapon. Let me read what it says in Contact Report 238, line 692. "Not only that, an Ishwish created the Ring Nebula in his megalomania, which has since thus been named the Eye of God, but his most distant descendants finally also came to Earth and terrorized this world here," and so on, which at any rate, as a rough measure, happened essentially for the first time about 389,000 years ago, when one disregards those deportations and conquests and other skirmishes that go back to around 20 million years ago. So the Lyrians were here about 389,000 years ago. This is when they kind of abused the Earth humans, and some of them got stranded here intentionally. They took their technology away, and they died on the Earth and entered into the reincarnational patterns of the Earth peoples. Askit has a little bit to say about the Earth humans' origin. That's what we're going to get into, the origin of us here on the Earth. And Askit says, "Since then, we again explored the expanses of your universe and several centuries ago discovered this solar system, and whereby this world, whose inhabitants show very old connection with the Plaiaren, also in the form of that which pertains to a mission, to be precise, the centuries by your time reckoning line up together to 33, during which we were again able to travel and explore your universe. What Asket, as you probably remember, is Billy's second mentor. He started working with her around 1953. She is from the Tao universe. Our universe is 46 trillion years old, and we have a sister universe called the Tao universe, according to Meyer information anyway. And these Timmers, as they're called, developed the technology to bridge the barrier between the two universes without damaging themselves or their universes. And let me continue with what Asket says. Through our incessant explorations, we again found this world as well as our original homeland and the very distant descendants of those who, from the earliest time, were the responsible ones who were relevant to the human life on this world. Because a portion of the humans of the earth were not born here, many are descendants of those who came out of the expanse of outer space, indeed from the space you named Lyra and Vega, with the Eye of God, the Ring Nebula. In those territories lie namely the real and ultimate original homeland of later terrestrial human races. Now, there are more and more planets being discovered all the time that are habitable by Kepler. And there are two identified planets orbiting a star not too unlike our own in the system of Lyra, around 1,200 light years away. And these two planets are water worlds. And one is named Kepler-62f. And the other one, I believe, is Kepler-69. And there's another one called Kepler-186f, just discovered in 2014, April. And I think it's about Earth size, that it could have liquid water. And it's the outermost world of a five-planet system, about three times closer to its star than the Earth is to the Sun. So I wonder how much we're not told. That's what I wonder. In Contact 210, while visiting Mars, Ptah explained to Billy that Mars had larger amounts of water in ancient times, large amounts of water. A lot of these rivers are filled in by dust and volcanic ash. And these rivers were larger than the largest rivers on Earth. He talked about 2,000-fold more water than is found on the largest rivers on Earth. On Mars today, now there are violently raging sandstorms which cover the entire planet. And enormous rivers or even canals are partially covered with sand, dust, and volcanic ash. But there were truly tremendous rivers at one time. And even those rivers, some of those were hundreds and thousands or hundreds of kilometers in diameter, which is incredible for a river if you think of it. Hundreds of miles to get over a river, that's incredible. And thousands of kilometers in length. Contact 251, it talks about potential wars we may have in the future, wars on Mars, and I assume that what it's referring to is we will have wars with people who leave the Earth and settle on Mars. Let me see what it says here. Aggression with Martian inhabitants will begin again and result in the actual launching of attacks on the 13 colonies of Mars. That's right. There will actually be 13 colonies on Mars. It reminds you of the American colonies. These events will be followed by 15 years of relative calm. A very vicious and aggressive act takes place on man's neighbor planet Mars, where numerous spaceships will attack and completely annihilate the planet until even its substance is eliminated. Well, let's hope that doesn't happen. Sometimes these prophecies are not for sure. They're probable things. Now, how do people get on the earth? It's just very complicated and kind of murky topic. Some people were brought here from the Seer system. There were a people that the Meyer information refers to as the Creator Overlords, who created a new human race with a limited lifespan of about 100 years. And these people were given genetics. They were genetically engineered to fight wars for the people who came into the Seer system, more descendants of the Lyrians. They were a genetically manipulated race. They fled the Sirius regions. They found their way to the Sol system, our system, where they settled on Mars, and they settled on Melona, and they constructed cities and pyramids and stations and other things, and they led a good life on Mars until finally the planet became uninhabitable. And there were a couple of reasons that Mars became uninhabitable, one of which was the destroyer comet, which came through and had a horrific effect on Mars. Other one was that Melona was destroyed by its people that lived on it. This destroyer comet, what I was talking about, is about 1.72 times the mass of the Earth. So a comet bigger than the Earth, almost twice as big, penetrated the Martian orbit and wrenched Mars into another orbit. And where Melona drifted away, however, because of the destroyer's powerful forces. Eventually, Melona was destroyed by its people. They channeled a ocean into a giant volcano. There is now an asteroid belt which exists between Mars and Jupiter, and it was the home to 400 million human beings who were the descendants from the genetically manipulated peoples. We still have those same genetic manipulations, by the way. There was also a great war on Melona about 73,000 years ago. And I think part of this whole action with the ocean into moving it into the volcano was in some way related to that war. As I said earlier, so we've had people that have came here from Mars. We might have gotten a few people from Melona before it was destroyed. People are here from the constellation of Lyra Vega, who actually entered in the reincarnation of Pattern's Earth. And the people from Lyra Vega are from a time-shifted, space-shifted configuration, a different dimension, as are the people from Sirius. We also have Oriental people here who came from the other side of the Milky Way. They lived on the other side of the central sun of our galaxy in a planet called NISAN. Excuse me, in a system called NISAN, a planet called Kudra. The Chinese people originally were called the Kitten, and the Japanese the Niper. And they were discovered by the Lyrians about 16 million years ago. These people from Lyra brought some of the people, the Kitten and the Niper people, back to Lazon, which was one of the Lyra Vega planets. Planet Kudra, again, was discovered by an expedition fleet from Lazan, where it left the Lyra systems approximately 16 million years ago, to conduct research and search for human life on the other side of the Milky Way. In the process, this fleet came upon the Kitten and the Niper races, the yellow races, the Chinese and the Japanese, and their expedition troops at the time brought about 4,000 people back to Lazon. And they settled on various planets. We also have naturally developing Earth humans. And I was talking about that a little bit last night. About 9 to 12 million years ago, we had some naturally developing Earth humans. They descended from a mammal, a very small and simple mammal called Adelis spatialis cromtoni, which comes from the late Triassic period about 225 million years ago. And some say that Adelis spatialis cromtoni is the common ancestor of all modern animals on the Earth. That's all mammals. In America Southwest, they discovered the Adelis spatialis cromtoni, a paleontologist named Adrian Hunt found the tiny skull, which was less than an inch long. And the Meyer information, especially if you read, for example, Bulletin 32, will tell you that humanity doesn't develop from apes, but develops from primates. And that happens all across our universe. We do not live a life based on instinct, but we have a consciousness that was developed over millions of years. Originally, when the universe was formed, there was about 343 different skin colors. And again, we have the leftover people from Mars and Melona here, who originally came from the Sirius system. So the races here are both terrestrial and extraterrestrial. And we've talked about Atlantis, which was about 130,000 years ago. One of the central figures of the whole story with Atlantis is a man. Contact Report 9 talks about it. His name was Semyasa, and he's described as one of the 200 leaders and sub-leaders who came to the Earth, who followed Eris the Barbarian. And one of the things Semyasa did was mate with an Earth woman. The Earth people were called Evas at that time. Semyasa actually did something that was forbidden. Eris the Barbarian became very enraged by this. But there was an offspring, who they called, Semyasa called his son Adam, which was a word that meant Earth human being. And eventually there was an equivalent of an Eve as well. Anyway, the mixing of the Earth peoples and the people from Beta Centauri, most of the people from in the Lyra Vega, particularly the Eris the Barbarian group, were from Beta Centauri, which is couple hundred light years away. But the crossing of the two peoples produced giants, huge giants, 40, 30 feet tall. Very strange indeed. We have in our Milky Way galaxy about 2.6 million civilizations. 2.6 solar systems with higher civilizations. I think about 7.5 million solar systems that can support life. Human beings across our galaxy can be anywhere from 16 inches tall to about 40 feet tall. So, interesting. Again, the Pleiadians say that our forefathers are their forefathers. The oldest branch of the human race that the Pleiadians have detailed information about is the Lyrians. The Lyrians, though, were in a different space-time configuration than us. The constellation of Lyra is about 20 to 30 light years from Earth. There are some planets and systems much farther away that are still in that constellation. Vega is the brightest star in the Lyra Vega system. And there's a class of stars that they call the Beta Lyra variables. These are binary stars. They're binary stars that have a common epicenter. They call it a barycenter. These binary stars, they rotate around this common center, and they are so close to each other that some of these binary stars in the Lyra Vega system actually lose material. You can see material going from one star to the other. There are also supergiant stars in the Lyra Vega system. One of them is called Betelgeuse or Betelgeuse. And Ptah told Billy about that in Contact Report 214. I'll read it here. It says, if I remember correctly, Ptah told me when he showed me, Billy calls stars entities. I'm not sure why. He says the entity on my great journey in 1975, that this is about 620 times the diameter of our sun. In addition, Alnitak, also such an entity or star, should have a luminosity that is 19,000 times that of our sun. We also have a binary star, a dark star. I've talked about this a time or two. It's about a light year away. It has its own planets. It's invisible by the naked eye, for the naked eye. I was trying to see. I don't have a whole lot of information in this particular passage about it. The radius of the dark star to Sol encompasses more than a light year, a little more than a light year, therefore more than 9.5 trillion kilometers. I think it's about a tenth the size of our sun. Yeah, it's 10 times smaller than our sun. Billy knew about this. He learned about this in 1975. I don't even know if our scientists really realize this yet. So anyway, I kind of stumbled through that a little bit. I think it's very interesting. We can talk about that a little more at some other time. I enjoy this history, this very unusual history that we have. Let me talk a little bit about Pleiaran history, just for a bit, and then we'll get back more on the spiritual teachings. The Lyrians had advanced to the point where some of them had mastered the almost unlimited powers of the human spirit. They had abilities of telepathy and telekinesis. These Lyrian Ishwishes did. Ptah's example of an Ishwish, Pelagon, is another Ishwish. And here's what it says from the contact notes. But this power, I'm talking about some of the power of their material consciousness of the Lyrians. That's why I call them Titans. But this power, still not controllably mastered, was used for wicked purposes and for mischief on many worlds. Even on the Lyrian homeworlds, the Ishwish leaders ruled with a cruel power. There was a time of about four centuries that the people that were under the rule of the Ishwish prepared secretly for a war of liberation. When the war finally broke out, three of the Lyrian homeworlds were completely destroyed by some massive weapon. Here's what the contact notes say about this weapon. It says, three worlds of the Lyra system were simply eliminated and dissolved to energy by a new process, which meanwhile on the Earth is already in the beginning of its development. In Earth chronology, the outbreak of the Liberation War in Lyra and Vega was around 230,000 years ago. Now, there was an Ishwish named Asael, who led some 360,000 Lyrians out of Lyra to escape the incredible wars that were going on there. Asael was a commander of one of the armies. In the contact notes, it says, and this is very interesting, it says, the high commander of the terrorizing armies was an Ishwish named Asael. And eventually I'll say I'll led many people out of the, well, this is Pleiades. This is very interesting. You know, well, I'll continue here. The saga that took place in Lyra in the ancient history was very involved, and it's a drama. So who knows? I don't think Asael was necessarily what you would call a good guy. So anyway, this group that he led, he had 183 of these giant motherships, 253 smaller ships, and they eventually found a new home. And it actually was in the Pleiaden star system. They settled on planets. They settled on a world named Era. This is really interesting, but kind of strange, because, you know, we have to kind of reinterpret this history, because some of this was given to us when, how can I say this? Originally, we were told that they were from the Pleiades, and in 1995, they revealed their true identity. Very, very unusual. Era is the home world of the Pleiaden. It's 500 light years away. It's in a different space-time configuration, some 80 light years. You got to go through a dimensional gate to get there. Era has their economy. They don't have money, which is interesting. I think that would probably be good if we could figure out a way not to have money. They have robot-assisted manufacturing. You have kind of a borrowed asset scheme. So you just, I guess if you need something, you just borrow it. There's no poverty whatsoever. Food, energy, and housing is free. They also have monogamy and polygamy. So I think they can have as many as four wives. They do not have on Era any bisexuality or homosexuality, because the Pleiadians say this is a natural genetic disorder that can be eradicated through genetic manipulation. And they also, they have virtually never have incompatible couples, because they have certain social sciences and astrology of all things, which helps in that sort of thing. Now, I had talked about Asael. So Asael eventually died, and he was succeeded by his daughter Pleia. And Pleia eventually went exploring again. And Pleia and her ships were following in the tail of the destroyer comet. And they noticed that in the tail of the destroyer comet was debris from their home world in Lyra Vega. But they followed this comet to Earth. And they found native Earth humans, which most were brown skin. However, they found white people on the planet. And some of these were descendants of about 144,000 people who came from Lyra. And essentially, Pleia was able to detect the Lyrian spirit forms of the colonists who had came 389,000 years ago. And they had degenerated into a very primitive state. And the people on the earth were very primitive, all of them at this time. And I talked about Melona and what happened. So about 116,000 BC, the Pleiaden people, the Lyrian people, just they had their own problems. And they just all left our solar system, I guess. And at this time, we were kind of on our own, so to speak. And then, and I don't know, but I don't think these dates are correct, because I think Well, I'm sure one of the notorious mistakes that exist in the translation of the contact notes are the dates, and they always get the dates wrong. So I think Pelagon came here about 150,000 years ago as a part of the recolonization of Earth. My notes here say like 48,000. I know that isn't correct. Now, Pelagon was very interesting. He's one of the greatest Plearn leaders. He brought 70,000 people, 200 scientists to Earth. And at this time, there was a great war raging on the three home planets, the Plearn home planets. So they took 70,000 people and they looked for refuge here on the Earth. And they were trying to flee the tyranny and the death that was in the Plearn system. And it's really interesting because Pelagon seemed to have what the Earth people thought were magical abilities to rule over life and death. He was sometimes seen floating in the air, held up by the power of his mind. He was also said to be able to cause plants to grow with his mind. And I think this is where one of the first God images came here on the Earth. Eventually, all the trouble in the Plearn system calmed down, and the spiritual leaders were able to gain control of things. Now, Pelagon was on the Earth at this time, and he brought these 70,000 people to the Earth, and they populated the whole Earth. And then Pelagon died, and another fellow took over by the name of Jesus, who was a cruel tyrant. So many people fled the Earth. Some of them settled in Beta Centauri. Some of the people that fled Earth went to the Barnard Star. The Barnard Star is a low-mass red dwarf star about 6 light years from Earth. I don't think a lot of the red dwarf stars necessarily produce planets which are habitable. And just FYI, the Alpha Centauri system appears to have a planet within it that might be habitable. Okay, I love going through this historical stuff. I'm going to try to resist the temptation of continuing in that sort of thing. I can't prove any of this, and I think that's the reason that Michael Horn never covers it, because I think it's true. I think for the most part it's true and it's absolutely fascinating. But I'm one of the few people that really talk about that. I don't know why. The emphasis it should be on the spiritual teaching. I totally get that. Don't get me wrong, but I think it's important to know this history. And it's extremely interesting. You know, one of the great analogies is our consciousness is analogous to kind of a tree. There's a part of the tree which you can't see, which is the root system, and then there's the trunk and the crown which you can see. So you know, what stabilizes the tree is the root system, and what stabilizes us is the spiritual teaching related to our consciousness. Now, I don't know if you've ever read And Still They Fly, I think it's called, and I have the book up there on my shelf. It's written by Guido Mooseberger, I think, who passed away. Well, his wife, Elizabeth, wrote part of the introduction in The Might of Thoughts. And maybe I can find that if I'm lucky here without taking too much time. You know, there's a lot that talks in the book about the evolution code and about the German language. And then there's definitions of words, and I should read these definitions online a little bit more. The book, The Might of Thoughts, came originally as an article called The Voice of the Aquarian Age, and Billy just kept elaborating on it, and it became a rather large book. So, I'll keep looking quickly. Ah, here it is. Now, this is sobering as hell. Well, she had written all this, I didn't realize, but I'll read this one chapter. It says, by means of his/her very own efforts of thinking, every human being forms his or her own personality, which is indeed identical to the consciousness. From that also develops the human being's inner nature, which changes in constant evolution by striving towards that which is higher. The impulses for striving higher thereby come out of the innermost nature, which is a component of the spirit form, and thereby purely creational. If the human being wants to make progress in his or her development, then he or she must make the effort to elaborate the impulses within his or her own thinking. Therefore, basically, no human being has it easy. Rather, all existing values and unvalues have always come about through one kind of thinking. So the book which lies before you is dedicated to a humankind which is ill in its consciousness, so that it again finds the creational natural way which it lost a long time ago. Everything which is materially visible, all character qualities, habits, and other peculiarities of the human being have been originally conceived by the thoughts in a long evolutionary process and are brought to realization by the might of the thoughts. For that reason, since time immemorial, it has been said that which the human being thinks, he or she becomes. Now that is a profound, profound little bit of information there. I wanted to switch quickly to something that I was reading today, which again was, you know, you read this stuff and you come back through it and you think, wow, you know, I never realized there was so much emphasis on this. It seemed like just something I just vaguely remember, and I didn't think there was a lot of information. And then I find, whoa, there's all this detailed information that I didn't really catch before. So, there's an inner nature. We have an inner nature, okay? We have an inner nature that comes from the spirit form. And we have an inner nature, which is kind of our own personality type of thing. And the two are opposed to each other, you could say. One, the false you, is kind of threatened by the part of you that's evolving. And I want to find out exactly. Let me read this highlighted section. It may not exactly relate to what we're talking about. Unfortunately, it is a fact that which is bad and negative, once it created, does not simply disappear again. Rather, it stores itself in the overall consciousness block in the planetary storage bank. So if you have negative thoughts which repeat, they'll be stored in your consciousness block and in the planetary storage banks, from where the human being can consciously or unconsciously call it all up again, over and over again, and I know we've all done that, and allow it to become the motivating power and might, which is really bad. And indeed, during the course of many reincarnations, so when you circulate garbage, and I know we all do it, I do it, we circulate garbage, you always got issues that bug you, and you're circulating them. They become part of the storage banks, and you reincarnate again after this life and you can pull that same crap back into your mind. That's how bad this is. Besides a human being, let me read from here. From where the human being can consciously or unconsciously, subconsciously call it up over and over again and allow it to become the motivating power and might, and indeed during the course of many reincarnations. Besides, the human being has been exposed through his or her reincarnations over many millennia to the so-called processes of civilization, which have furnished him or her with bad, wrong, unhealthy, and negative factors. So we're getting negative, all kinds of negative garbage from our own society, which repeatedly have an effect on him or her when he or she consciously or subconsciously reaches the realms and takes up the impulses. And are additionally able to imprint bad and negative sides into the inner nature of the human being. So this garbage, these negative thoughts which come through our mind, get implanted into the planetary storage banks, and we can pull the same garbage in another lifetime. We can start recycling garbage, and it goes into the inner nature. When he or she is inattentive and is not aware of them, or he or she is consciously lets them penetrate her, hence the human being must always consciously concern him or herself with actually forming his or her own inner nature into the better self by recognizing, adopting, and realizing that creational impulses which come from the innermost self, the bad and negative, can penetrate the human being and overcome him or her at any time. And any time. That's why I have those four things which I remember to say. I am confident. I'm optimistic. I'm relaxed and I'm cheerful. And tell yourself that and get out of the garbage. The bad and the negative can penetrate the human being and overcome him or her at any time if he or she is not constantly, consciously heedful and on the lookout. And therefore, it is also the case that every human being also carries the bad and negative in himself, herself, to a certain extent, indeed in this or her inner nature. When he himself slash she herself what has imprinted in complete contempt for the opposite impulses of the innermost creational nature. And indeed, no human being should get carried away in the erroneous belief that he or she does not carry this self-created bad part in himself slash herself, because such a belief would actually amount to an unbelievable presumption. Regardless of how nice and loving and how progressive a human being may be, in his slash her inner nature, he slash she carries characteristics in forms of self-created things which are bad, evil, negative, and negating, even if he or she has evolved so far and very high. So even people that have evolved to a very high level still carry this crap around. So that means at any point a person can fall, let's say. Everything can suddenly break free and break through when one does not practice constant watchfulness and does not nurture the constant conscious evolution in every respect with all means of intelligence and reason. It follows from that the only protection against that which is bad, negative, and negating is total control over the inner nature, and with that also over the thought principle. If these two factors are formed according to the inner nature and its high striving impulses, which are creational and deliver the fundamental values. So we have two inner natures, one which is influenced by the impulses of your spirit form, other one is just it's the false self. It's threatened by evolution. It's you could call it the bad side of your personality. This is profound stuff. This is very, very profound stuff. Sometimes I have to just take a break from it. It's just so profound. We have a spirit form. It never dies. It cannot be harmed by anything in the physical realm. The spirit form has a controlling factor called the Gemut. The Gemut controls the thoughts and the feelings of the associated with the spirit form. The Gemut is referred to as the spiritual block and factor within the spirit body of a life form. We do have a spirit body. I have not read anywhere in the Meyer material where it goes into that much detail about the spirit body. Eventually, we won't need a physical body. But that's many reincarnations from now. In this case, the human being regulates and looked after the spirit consciousness-based feelings and the spirit consciousness-based thoughts. So the Gemut is like the counterpart of the psyche. The Gemut is the part of your spiritual consciousness that controls thoughts and feelings in the spirit form. You actually do have thoughts and feelings in your spirit form. The Gemut cannot be influenced by negative powers. It cannot have negative thoughts. Isn't that nice to know? It can only have neutral, positive thoughts, which is a wonderful thing. The Gemut always exhibits an equalized harmony from which the half-material psyche profits, because the Gemut supplies the psyche with these harmonious swinging waves in necessary amounts, in which case a part of these swinging waves originate from the realm of cosmic electromagnetic life energy. So if you remember, I've talked about just occasionally from time to time these swinging waves, and I first learned about them reading in the Goblet of Truth. There's a passage there, it's called What the Truth Knows to Say, and it goes on to say rivers, stones, plants, animals, bushes, trees, everything that crawls and flies on the earth is a life form with a spirit form, and these spirit forms are on a journey through time which involve many, many lifetimes, and death is just the passage into the realm of pure spirit. And many of these creatures are connected by psychic vibrations. Those are the swinging waves. And they know about each other. And I think one of the side effects of the swinging waves, you'll see it in nature, when the flock of birds, they all act like one animal. At the same time, they instantly change direction altogether. Now, we have within the human being the swinging wave as well, which goes from the spiritual consciousness to the material consciousness. The swinging wave, I think, is a source of great power. And I think the Lyrians, the people from Lyra Vega, had mastered using the power of the swinging wave. And I'm getting into a little speculation here, but contrary to the material consciousness, material consciousness is able to create negative as well as positive and neutral positive thoughts. The spirit consciousness operates only in the form of equalizedness and thus in a neutral positive form. Therefore, negative and positive are harmoniously equalized and also create a corresponding harmony, which the Gemut absorbs and works with, and indeed in both the spiritual as well as the material realm. Here's the other thing which is strange. The Gemut has no direct connection with the material body. So the Gemut is not related to the material body at all. It says a lot here, which I'm just skimming through very, very quickly. Some other stuff, and I've never really gotten that much. It's talking about some misunderstandings related to the Gemut, and I've never, you know, before I started studying the Meyer material, I never knew about the Gemut, so I didn't have really any misunderstandings. The first 25 or 30 pages of the book, The Psyche, which is what I'm reading right now, is so profound to me. I had to read it over and over. I don't know how many times I had to read this, because it defines these areas in both our material and our spiritual consciousness. And it defines what these different things do. And we have a psyche which controls the thoughts and feelings of the material consciousness. And it's very vulnerable. Your psyche can go insane. The Gemut, on the other hand, it cannot be harmed by anything in the material world. It never has a negative thought. It's probably the source of your real inner I, your real inner self. It only thinks in neutral positive forms. I wish I only thought in neutral positive ways. This is one thing I want to read out loud here, because I think this is really what's holding us back in our advancement. It says here, the Earth human being is particularly expert at clothing matters in words and terms which are inappropriate and completely false. Let me give you some examples. Demons, angels, fallen angels, all of this is completely false. But it's a vernacular, it's a vocabulary that's been created that has a life of its own. And once you give these terms to things, it causes all kinds of misinterpretations. Let me continue. As a rule, this happens due to a complete ununderstanding and the misinterpretation of the actual connections and the facts of reality. In particular, the mass of the blame is borne by the esoterics, the parapsychologists, as well as occultists of all eras, who twisted the matters of the teaching of the spirit and the material consciousness connections into an endless false explanations and false teachings, especially regarding the teaching of the spirit and of the material consciousness. The most complicated and false connections were crafted and spread as irrational teachings, which have been preserved until today. Not at least to blame are also the old occultists who conjured up and wrote down things in Sanskrit, their fantasy-drenched teachings about spirit and consciousness, and all the erroneous facts connected thereto. Consequently, these teachings are often confused, unreal, uncomprehensible to such a degree that no one could think lunatics had the audacity to explain things that were absolutely uncomprehensible for them. This also applies to the concerns of the mentality as well as psyche and the Gemut. And let me read this one section. Since time immemorial, the psyche and the Gemut are presented as factors which in no wise correspond to reality. The psyche, for example, is described as the soul, which supposedly continues to exist as a fine-fluidal body after death. This erroneous occult and religious irrational teaching is already ancient and has to this day obstinately been preserved in esoteric, parapsychological, religious, and other occult circles, through which the human beings of Earth continue to be led into confusion. But as it appears, the case of the psyche soul fantasized by human beings who had no notion of the actual connections of the concerns of the spirit and the material consciousness, as well as the connecting factors, So it also happens with the Gemut. Namely, this is presented as a factor of the physical body, supposedly storing and reflecting the feelings of the human being, which is why a Gemut's mention becomes spoken of. So I think some of this stuff has gotten into the German language. If the human being has taken a distinct form. However, the Gemut, truthfully, does not correspond to this explanation because it does not belong in the realm of the material body. If you haven't got the book, The Psyche, let me recommend that. Also, if you skim through the first 20 or 30 pages, go back and read them again because you missed it. I guarantee you missed it. It's some of the most profound stuff that you'll ever read. Anyway, it's a preparation for the book, The Might of Thoughts. I'm still stuck in The Might of Thoughts. I'm almost through it for the fourth time. And I feel like I just barely understand it. So the fact that I've read it so many times is not really a something necessarily to be proud of, because that means I didn't get it the first time, the second time, or the third time. I'm just barely getting it now. So take the time to study this information. Develop a habit, a time when you read it. A good time is in the morning if you've got a little time where you're just trying to wake up. Great something to read on your days off. It can help you in so many ways, The Might of Thoughts. There's so much in there. That's all I can say. Just keep plugging away at it, and it will help you. You have to apply it diligently. You have to really, really concentrate on it. The human being is the forger of his or her own fortune. The human being forms his or her own luck by means of his or her thoughts. So you really are in control of the circumstances of your life. And if you've got bad circumstances right now, you probably created those. Maybe unconsciously, maybe subconsciously, or maybe consciously. Maybe you got stuck in the rotation of negative thinking. Apply the following to your own thoughts. The human being must make the effort to clarify his or her thoughts so they become more valuable, more purposive, and more productive. And they will form in a harmonious, equalized way. Clarify your thoughts. Make the effort. Practice clarifying your thoughts. Clarifying your thoughts can eventually lead to a harmonious life. Well, thanks for listening. You've been listening to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. Have a great evening.